Hello, Matt.
Hello, Bill.
How are you doing this week?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing all right. We seem to be days away from the game changer in the Republican
That's
primary.
Right.
All the Republicans are waiting for someone to change the game because the game's been so boring for so long.
Yeah, I think Rick Perry is getting in. I'm actually heading down tomorrow, which will be Thursday, to Charleston, South Carolina, to attend the third annual Red State Gathering. And this is the third that I've been to, actually. The first one was in Atlanta, then Austin, Texas, and now Charleston, South Carolina. Texas Governor Rick Perry will be speaking there, as will South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. And Politico reported that Rick Perry, you know, may have some sort of a pre-announcement at the gathering. So I'm obviously hoping that happens.
So the rumor is that he will actually announce that he will somehow hint at running?
I think so, because the next day Perry is apparently going to be in Iowa for a fundraiser, and then I think New Hampshire after that. So we'll see. I take everything I hear in the media with a grain of salt, but you know, Politico was saying that that they're hearing that he will either announce at the Red State Gathering or have some sort of a pre-announcement, you know, signal that he is indeed running.
I mean, I guess the theory might be that's not been confirmed. He's a three-state tour that perhaps he would build up to a big finish on day three.
Maybe, who knows? This has not been confirmed, and media outlets sometimes get things wrong. Let's be honest about that. But look, Rick Perry has a history of wooing conservative bloggers. He sponsored this Perry Blogger Summit a couple years ago, where he brought a lot of prominent conservative writers and bloggers to Austin, as well as Texas-based bloggers. And then the Red State Gathering last year was in Austin, Texas. Perry was there, made himself very available, had, you know, invited some of us to dinner, had a couple outings. So he really is going out of his way to woo conservative bloggers. And by the way, this is not inconsequential. Conservative bloggers, and especially prominent folks like, say, Eric Erickson, who runs Red State, can make a big difference when it comes to winning a Republican primary. John McCain got that. He made himself incredibly available, hosting weekly blogger calls, inviting, you know, I was on, when I worked at townhall.com as a blogger, I got on the Straight Talk Express and went to town hall meetings with him. It paid off for him because it's a matter of access. And as much as reporters and bloggers, you know, sort of lament the access game, the truth is, if you get to meet a politician and you like them and they're charismatic and charming, the odds are it may influence the coverage that that politician gets. And if their people respond to you promptly and give you information and keep you posted, it may influence coverage, even if you try to always be down the middle. And look, I mean, we've got other conservative candidates like Michelle Bachmann, who frankly hate me and the Daily Caller probably, who aren't going to be returning our calls. And so I think if Rick Perry can become the Red State candidate, and I think he can. Remember, Eric Erickson a couple years ago was pulling for Mitch Daniels. There is no obvious candidate for, you know, activist bloggers, the kind of folks who actually don't just write about politics but root for politicians. They don't have a candidate right now. It sure ain't Mitt Romney. Tim Pawlenty seems to have faded, and we'll see what he does in Ames. Maybe he'll win Ames. I think Herman Cain is very much liked and admired by a lot of conservative bloggers, but a lot of folks don't see him as the winner. And so I think Rick Perry has a lot of openings, but one of the many openings he has, frankly, is with the conservative bloggers.
Now, you compared his outreach strategy to McCain's in 08. Now, McCain did that because he had a huge problem with the conservative movement, and he was trying to mitigate it. And I would argue he never really overcame it. Maybe he lessened it to some degree, but the conservative movement was still trying to stop him. In the primary season, they just couldn't pick a horse to with which to do it. But is Perry trying to damp down a possible possible conservative opposition to him because of parts of his record, or is this just an outgrowth of his natural conservatism?
I think that, first of all, let me address McCain. McCain, you're right. I mean, he had a lot of problems with the conservative base. A lot of people were skeptical of him. I mean, I myself have major problems with McCain-Feingold. But you have to say, considering all the problems that John McCain had, he overperformed in terms of the coverage he got from conservative blogs. I think he did very well, and part of it was just that he made himself available. He held these weekly conference calls and took all sorts of questions. And I mean, and when I was on the Straight Talk Express with him, Bill, he literally, nothing was off bounds. You could ask him anything, and he was on the record the whole time. Now, later, he tightened it up a little bit, but there was a long stretch of time when McCain was very available. His team was calling bloggers, emailing bloggers, giving them information. And the thing that I liked about McCain is if you wrote something bad about him, they didn't write you off. Like the way that some candidates will just, you know, assume that you're the enemy. If you write something bad about Mitt Romney, you're probably not going to ever hear from them again. John McCain did the opposite. You write something bad about John McCain, they would be on the phone to you or sending you an email. Hey, did you hear that, you know, McCain did this or that he's sponsoring this legislation?
Well, now, shifting back to Perry, what is the impetus for Perry's strategy? I mean, there are some aspects of his record in Texas which some conservatives have not liked. So is the blog strategy an attempt to minimize that, or is it just simply Perry's a conservative most of the time, and he just likes hanging out with conservative bloggers, and it's all just one big happy family?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I mean, number one, I think that Perry, I think, very much grasped the importance of conservative bloggers. And by the way, this is my theory. He may show up and be boring at the Red State Gathering and have no announcement, which would be, at this point, disappointing because Politico's hyped it. So, I mean, this is just my theory. But assuming that I'm right, Perry, during his reelection campaign against Kay Bailey Hutchison, wouldn't do editorial board meeting around the state of Texas with, you know, these, editors and journalists in Texas. And yet he hosted this blogger summit where he was granting interviews to, like, pretty obscure conservative bloggers. I mean, some of which were – well, some of them were highly prominent and some of them were obscure Texas bloggers. But he really made himself very available to conservative bloggers, I mean, big and small. So I think he grasps it. Specifically to answer your question, I don't think – no, you're right. I mean, there are certain things that some conservatives don't like about him. He endorsed Rudy Giuliani for president. That's going to be an issue. He supported this HPV mandatory vaccination for girls, middle school girls, I think, which some conservatives had a problem with. There was the highway or whatever from Mexico to Canada that people like Jerome Corzi had some conspiracy theory about. But by and large, I think this is more of a proactive, offensive strategy, which is to say, not a defensive strategy. I don't think this is done to mitigate problems the way that McCain had to. I think this is actually a way for him to excel and to really capture a niche that has been largely ignored by everybody else.
None of the other primary candidates have done any kind of coordinated conservative blog outreach so far?
I mean, they try to. They've all tried, but nobody has really done it right. And that's because, frankly, other than McCain, the attitude that most of these candidates have is that that bloggers aren't as important as reporters. And even early on, if they start to take bloggers seriously, like Tim Pawlenty a couple years ago had this really cool happy hour at CPAC where there were a whole bunch of bloggers. I was there, and he hung out and drank beer and talked about hockey. Like, they start off with that outreach, but then it sort of falls by the wayside when it comes, you know, when they're not doing well in Iowa, and all of a sudden now they have to go, you know, kiss the ring of some district chairman in Des Moines or something. And I mean, it's understandable because the Ames straw poll is where, you know, people like Bachman and Pawlenty have essentially said, you know, I have to win Iowa. But what happens is that the national conservative bloggers especially fall by the wayside. So, like, some of them have just had no outreach effort, and others who sort of dip their toe in the outreach effort just end up abandoning it because it's not the urgent. It's the it may be the important, but it's not the urgent. This is an area where Rick Perry can capitalize and essentially has this space all to himself. He is naturally predisposed to be popular among this group, and with a little bit of effort, he can really kick butt here. And, of course, this weekend, speaking to, you know, everybody else is going to be in Des Moines, Iowa, talking to the mainstream media and to Iowa voters. I mean, of course, important, obviously an important state. Rick Perry will be on Saturday in South Carolina with 100 or 200, I don't know how many are going to show up, a couple hundred of the most important conservative bloggers in America.
So let's shift gears for a second to talk about the Red State Gathering, because I'm not sure how many people know that there is a Red State Gathering and what it is, and you know how is it different than CPAC or Right Online? Is this going to become a Netroots Nation-esque conservative blog gathering, something that of larger scope, because Rick Perry is coming and treating it as a venue to make news at?
Right. Well, so this is the third annual one. I've been to all three, or I plan to go to the third one, which will mean that I've been to all three. The first one was in Atlanta, Georgia, where Eric Erickson lives in Georgia. The second one was in Austin, Texas, and Governor Perry was a major part of that event. I mean, there were other speakers there. In fact, Nikki Haley was at that one as well. But this one is in South Carolina. It's the Red State Gathering, and they actually only hold them in red states. So,
I'm not sure Austin counts.
Austin, it was in Texas. But, yeah, Austin's the bluest part of Texas, probably. And, interestingly, one of my favorite cities. As a new urbanist, you know that. Austin's a great town. If you haven't been there, you should go. So I don't think they aspire to be like the right's version of Netroots Nation. I mean, that's pretty much the Red Online Conference. This is really for Red State bloggers. And remember, Red State is, I mean, number one, arguably the most important or significant blog on the right, depending on how you look at it. They're an activist blog, and like the Daily Caller, which I would classify as like a journalist blog, that does mostly straight reporting with some conservative opinion. Red State is very much an activist blog, proudly so.
So when you say only Red State bloggers are going to be there, you mean people who only blog at redstate.com?
Right. I mean, anybody can go.
But that's what's primarily geared towards.
Right. And so, I mean, everybody knows Eric Erickson or Caleb Howell or, you know, the most prominent bloggers. But there are a lot of people who are like diarists, right, who just like, you know, just like Daily Coast, right? You have people who aren't necessarily always promoted to the front page.
Well, of course, and that was the origin of Netroots Nation. It was initially Yearly Coast. It was initially geared to be about people who blog at Daily Coast coming together, and if anyone else wants to show up, you know, great. And it just has grown from that to become an all-encompassing liberal blog conference. But you don't think that's what Eric's agenda is with the Red State Conference, to grow beyond something being a gathering for Red State bloggers?
I mean, they've shown no signs of wanting to do that. This one got a lot of attention and discussed even, I think, I saw it last night on NBC Nightly News. Brian Williams mentioned that Governor Perry was speaking at a meeting in South Carolina. I don't think they said Red State Gathering, but certainly Fox News and others have said. So it's gotten a lot of attention. It's a fairly low-key event in the sense that, like, there's not a whole lot of fuss and muss. It's just, you know, good speakers, and then there's outings that are it's kind of different, I would say, than like a Right Online conference that is maybe a little more polished.
More like a class reunion than a conference.
Exactly. And, you know, Erickson, I mean, by his own right, I mean, we saw where you have all these, you know, members of Congress essentially calling him up, asking permission to vote for, you know, the Boehner bill or whatever. So clearly, I mean, he's an opinion leader. And so he basically says, come to South Carolina, and people come to South Carolina.
Now, just to shift this back to Perry for a second, is his choice of venues like this and his snubbing of Ames, which one might think the Iowa activists would not be very thrilled with, your point earlier that he convened the group in Texas before and didn't bother the editorial boards. This was a point that Dan Balls of the Washington Post made in a column today, that, you know, this type of, you know, setting his own rules has worked in Texas, but It's very unsure whether it works in a presidential campaign when you have a lot more constituencies that you have to reach out to and appeal to. So you're arguing that this is going to be a great springboard for him if he actually follows through and chooses to run to consolidate the conservative base, the Republican primary vote. But does it raise a red flag as far as his staying power beyond that if he's only going to stay within his comfort zone?
It's an interesting point, Bill, that he is being a bit unconventional. I think he's the guy who can sort of merge the unconventional conservative grassroots thing with the establishment experience thing. And it's a fine line that you have to walk. He's taken chances. I mean, I think that the prayer meeting in Houston last weekend was a chance. It paid off. I mean, it worked out, but it was a gamble. What if nobody showed up, right?
Well, it worked out and everyone showed up. I don't know if it works out as far as how his appeal is to a broader swath of the country.
What if one of the speakers had said something highly controversial from the state? I mean, there were a lot of things. Football player said that, there are three things that can happen with a forward pass and two of them are bad, something like that. There's a lot of things that could have gone wrong at that meeting, and yet they didn't, so it worked out. So I think Perry has done things his own way. In a sense, there is a bit of a swagger the way that George W. Bush had it. And we know that that's the biggest problem that Perry has. So this sort of my way or the highway thing could reinforce the notion that he's somehow like Bush. I mean, so far he's gotten away with it. So far, every little thing he's done is magic. He is literally, it's been perfect so far. I mean, look at the luck. What is the luck that you can be out of a race this long? Like, you're not in the race, and yet... So you're avoiding all the problems, all the attacks, and yet you can still get in. What are the odds that your campaign manager and your top strategist will go to work for another candidate and all quit to come back to work for you? I mean, that's what happened. These guys were all working for Newt Gingrich, a month or two ago. So, I mean,
if this parallel fully holds up, but there has always been, in every recent presidential race, an early period with discontent of the field, and then someone comes in late with a lot of hullabaloo who seems a little bit more unconventional, and then they actually make the decision, get on the stage, and then completely flop because actually running is a whole lot different than teasing about running. Wesley Clark had a big flop. Fred Dalton Thompson had a big flop. Now, I think Perry is a bit more of a seasoned campaigner than those two.
Yeah.
But there is the question about everything might be – it's easier for everything to be magic when you are not actually running. When you are actually running, it's a whole different ballgame.
Right. No, and you're right. No, but let's look at those two examples because this is a blog post. Because these are it's an interesting analogy, but it is, as you alluded to, it is dramatically flawed. Wesley Clark had never, as far as I know, run for anything ever in his life. He gets in late, I think September of 2003.
Right, later than now. This is still sort of early,
maybe
relatively speaking.
So it's September or October of 2003.
Oh, no, that would be analogous then. I'm sorry.
Well, but Wes Clark had never run for anything ever.
Right.
And he made some immediate mistakes. So we'll compare him to Rick Perry. I mean, Rick Perry has, I think, won seven elections. He was just in a high-profile race against a sitting U.S. senator who was primarying him for governor. He has been, on Morning Joe. The guy, he is a seasoned politician, as you said. So I think that the Wes Clark analogy is flawed. And the Fred Thompson, I never bought into Fred Thompson. Go back and look. I mean, I know you're not questioning me, but seriously, to the folks out there, go back and look at what I wrote about Fred Thompson when he got in the race. When I was at townhall.com.
I've never accused you of being a Thompson file.
You know who was? Is Eric Erickson. But I never bought into Fred Thompson. I never saw the appeal. He wasn't even my favorite character on Law and Order, let alone my favorite presidential. The guy had no energy.
He was my favorite in Feds with Mary Gross.
But Rick Perry is exciting and charismatic and likable and in a way that Fred Thompson was not. So, I mean, It is an interesting historical analogy, but I think it is flawed.
Well, I mean, it only holds true if he gets in and he proves to not be as good as advertised. I mean, I agree that it's more likely he can make the transition because he has much more of a experienced campaigning background. But, you know, running nationwide is not the same as running in Texas. And we don't know how well he makes the transition until he actually makes it.
No, it's true. It's true. But, you know, also his campaign manager was and his general consultant, Dave Carney. So two of his guys were just on the Newt Gingrich race, which they helped.
Mattress, fantastic presumably. Experience to bring any other national campaign.
But think of it
this way.
That's
a cheap shot. They're experienced guys.
No. But look, I don't even care about the cheap shot. Think of it this way. Let's say they made their mistakes on that race, right? I mean, it's like go to someone else's race, run into the ground, and learn, and then don't make the mistakes again.
I counsel you to stay in the country throughout the duration of your campaign.
Right. Yeah, I mean, just do that. Just as long as you're not hiking the Appalachian Trail, I think you're okay. But no, I mean, it's so much of it, it's humorous. I guess we should move on, but we'll keep an eye on Rick Perry. I think he's the real deal, but who knows? You're right. It's like a football game or a boxing match. I mean, until you take the first punch, you don't know if you can take a punch. And so it's possible that Rick Perry gets in and flames out, but I'm telling you, if I have to put money on somebody, I think the guy has what it takes.
So the other big election news this week, I would say, is Wisconsin. Certainly on the left, this has been a main focus of interest for a long time and still will probably continue to be because the prospect that there'll be a recall attempt against the governor still is on the table. And I know MSNBC went wall-to-wall with this last night. I'm not sure if CNN or Fox did. I wasn't watching. Do you happen to know?
I was not paying attention at all.
I would bet they didn't, is my guess. I think this was a subject of such strong interest to the progressive community. It's only driven a lot by blog interest. Even though Democrats came one seat short of an actual takeover of the Wisconsin State Senate, they won two. And so you're still seeing in the blogosphere, I think maybe most prominently Digby, folks at my own organization site, Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, also making that case that merely by putting folks on notice, making the folks in power uncomfortable, winning a couple seats on Republican turf, certainly seeming to move the needle from where it was in 2010 in Wisconsin. Still is a momentum builder and is giving Democrats reasons. You know, there's a reason for us to move on here and push on and do the recall attempt against Scott Walker because the electorate in 2012, the electorate in 2011 was different than 2010, and electorate in 2012 in a presidential year is going to be different than 2010 too. So I think Nate Silver at his 538 blog in the New York Times said, 2011 essentially is the election results seem to be a midpoint between 2008 when Obama won big in Wisconsin and 2010 when Republicans won big in Wisconsin. And if it stayed that way, you have a nail biter race across the board in 2012. And I'm not one to say that whatever happens in 2011 is a predictor of 2012. It sort of suggests that there is a lot of fluidity here. But I'm sure on the conservative side, there is not acceptance of the results in Wisconsin being a clear victory for Democrats.
That's a laughable theory that this was in any way a victory for them. It is patently absurd. And the expectation set by liberals themselves going into this was that this was a major opportunity and they would either seize it or not. They did not. They missed, apparently, that opportunity. And so I think it becomes a victory for Republicans. Now, I do have to say, I don't blame the media outlets. Like, this morning on Morning Joe, they really didn't cover it. I don't blame them. I don't think that's necessarily media bias in terms of ideological bias. I think it has to do with newsworthy bias, right? So if Democrats pick up three seats and take the Senate, then that spells trouble for Governor Walker, and that's a that's an interesting news story. But as it is, we essentially have the status quo, which is not an interesting news story.
Well, let me ask you this question, though. Do you think after this, because what has happened so far since the takeover a lot of state houses by Republicans in 2010, there were a lot of hard-charging governors trying to implement conservative reforms very quickly and abruptly, Wisconsin, Ohio, Florida, to some extent New Jersey, though Christie was elected a year earlier. And that seems to be somewhat stalled out now, and there seems to be more hesitancy for other states to follow their molds because all their popularity ratings started to drop. So do you think after this Wisconsin election, if this is such a big victory for Republicans, is there going to be a fresh round of hard-charging conservative reforms for thinking, okay, we can do this now. We didn't lose a state house. We have all the reason in the world to push on here. Or is this hesitancy going to remain because at minimum there was some sort of backlash to it saying, you know what, there are risks. There are political risks in pushing too hard too fast.
I think it's essentially as if it never happened. So I don't think that it emboldens Republicans to be more risky or more aggressive. I don't think it deters them from being more aggressive. I think it's essentially a wash. And I think that you've seen that some Republican governors have taken a different tack, who have attempted to reform the system in a less controversial way. And you have others who have essentially, you know, taken the Scott Walker model. But I don't think that the fact that these recall efforts were launched will have any impact in terms of deterring Republicans from aggressively seeking to tackle, you know, problems with revenue or whatnot in their state. So I think it would have only worked if you pull a gun on somebody, you have to be willing to pull the trigger, and they did not. They threatened Republicans, and they did not finish them.
I think you'd argue they might have missed between the eyes, but perhaps they got a shoulder.
I don't see. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't see a lot of. You know, I don't see a lot of Republicans worried today or concerned about this. I think Republicans won. So, I mean, if anything, they'd be emboldened, but I just think it's probably just a wash.
Well, let me do a protracted segue from that to the super committee. And my segue is that you just had a CNN poll come out saying that Republican Party unfavorability was at all-time high since they've been pulling the question from 1992, higher than what it was during the Clinton impeachment. And this is coming out of the aftermath of the debt limit deal, where Obama's numbers have held steady, but Republican numbers have taken a tumble, even though the left is mad at Obama in many respects because of the deal itself. Politically speaking, he seems to be getting the better end of it. So what happens this week, we get super committee picks. The super committee is an outgrowth of the debt limit deal. Six Republicans, six Democrats have to come together, propose deficit reduction steps by November, and they have to be voted on by both bodies of Congress in December without amendments, without filibusters. So that's why the super committee nomenclature. And the picks that Boehner and McConnell made, and I'm specifying these aren't all of them, but particularly Senator Rob Portman, Congressman Dave Camp, and Congressman Fred Upton, seem to me to not be Tea Party picks. These seem to be people who are more inclined to make a deal than you might respect considering the negotiating posture Republicans to this point, and And there are certainly bloggers on the left who are unhappy with the picks that Senator Harry Reid made. Dean Baker, who blogs for the Center for Economic Policy Research, he has a Beat the Press blog there. He slapped the Washington Post for saying the pick of John Kerry by Harry Reid will appease liberals when John Kerry just was on Meet the Press saying we should compromise on Social Security and Medicare. So the main issue that liberals are nervous about, or some liberals are nervous about, is not where Kerry is at. So Dean Baker took a swipe there. So you seem to act, and there was a blog post at Red State, and it wasn't by Eric, I forget who the person's name was, who tried to preempt conservative complaining about Upton and Portman and Camp by saying, yeah, you know, you don't need to, you know, tease that out or analyze or whatnot, because the Democrat picks are so far to the left, they'll never come to a deal. And that, to me, just seems to be a complete misunderstanding. The people themselves. It's clear that Reid picked people who have some inclination to deal. I mean, Baucus has dealt with Republicans before. Patty Murray, I think, is more of a blank slate, so you don't know where she might go. But you don't need them all to deal. You just need one or two. And so if you have Kerry and Baucus who have either said they're willing to deal, who have shown their willingness to deal in the past, if you have Fred Upton, who the Tea Party hates for passing legislation that's going to phase out incandescent light bulbs, you have Dave Camp reportedly was unhappy with the Ryan budget and didn't want to put it on the floor, and you have Rob Portman who's on record saying that there are some types of revenue increases that he would entertain, that seems to me to at least increase the possibility of the so-called grand bargain with tax increases on the wealthy combined with some sort of entitlement cuts in Social Security and Medicare, you know, maybe not over 50% chance, but higher chance than what you might have thought 24 hours ago.
Well, first, what's up with the super thing? We've got these super PACs, super committees, super Tuesday, and I'm waiting for the super politicians because everything else is super, except our lives.
That's just lack of creativity in Washington pundit circles for you.
Second, though, here's my understanding, right? So this bill, if Congress can take care of this situation and cut spending, then you don't need to go to the super committees, right?
No, the super committee has to meet. The super committee's job is to come up with the extra cuts in spending or increases in revenue. They have to do proposals by November 23rd. And then the Congress has to vote on them by December 23rd with no amendments, no filibuster.
Now, one of the members – okay, so that's interesting. Now, one of the members of the committee is Pat Toomey.
Right.
The Pennsylvania senator who formerly headed the Club for Growth. He is obviously a fiscal conservative. Do you know the rules? What if he vehemently opposes?
The rules are –
raising taxes, for example, can he essentially veto it? That decision?
No, he cannot. He could not unilaterally. It is a simple majority. You have six Democrats and six Republicans. You just need seven to have the proposals that get sent directly to the floor of Congress. And so what both sides, I think, have been worried about is don't pick a single turncoat who can align with the other six of the other party and ram a deal down our throats. You now have the possible ingredients.
Five turncoats.
I'm sorry?
This is like they got five turncoats.
Well, that's my point. You could easily foresee, you know, a 4-3 matchup where there are individuals who are more ideologically inclined who don't come on the deal like Pat Toomey, but they aren't enough to stop a deal from getting to the floor of Congress. And so I saw the pick of Pat Toomey on the Republican side to be very thin cover for the fact that they snubbed the Tea Party. They looked at those polls and said, our negotiating posture is not going to help us in 2012. We need to at least make some sort of effort to say we're trying to cut a deal here. Maybe they won't cut a deal at the end, but they're at least trying to make a show of it. And Pat Toomey, unless the entire party decides to walk, or both parties decide to walk, or the middle ground, just the center does not hold, Toomey is not in a position to singularly stop a deal from occurring.
I'm seeing on Twitter, Palin bus tour to roll into Iowa.
Palin is back. So,
giddy up and time to sell more copies of The Quotable Rogue. So here's my thinking. I have not been following, obviously, I've not been following this closely since the debt vote. But I wouldn't be so. It seems like the Simpson Bowls thing could come back now, right? I mean, if based on what you're telling me about five of the six members of this committee, couldn't they just go back to the Simpson Bowls proposal and say, this is our jumping off point?
They will certainly be looking at Simpson Bowls and Gang of Six. I mean, these are your basic elements for what a Grand Bargain Compromise would be. I mean, Obama has basically said, and this is why I personally disagree with the critique that he has been a weak negotiator. All this, you can still disagree with what he's done, but I don't think the critique is based upon his weakness or naivete. He has made very clear that he wants a grand bargain that pairs entitlement reform and tax reform, and presumably that would mean raising revenue through tax reform and reducing payments through entitlement reform. And if they're not done together, then he's not going to do them. So he put them together for Boehner and said, are you willing to do this? And Boehner seemed to take the deal seriously but couldn't pull the trigger on it. And so Obama then said, okay, well, I'm going to take them both off and let's create instead a Rube Goldberg trigger mechanism that will do our best to not favor one party or another. So if we don't have a deal, you have these very severe cuts in defense and very severe cuts for healthcare providers. And Jonathan Chait at the Republic said, you're basically creating a dynamic where two very powerful lobbies, the defense lobby and the health provider lobby, are going to be swarming Capitol Hill and swarming Republicans in particular, saying, for Pete's sake, do a deal already or else the hammer's going to come down on us. Now, again, it may not work. It may not change the dynamic the way the president wants it to. And if you're a liberal progressive, you may not want this deal to happen because of what it might mean for Medicare and Social Security. But it does seem to be an attempt to change the dynamic from what it currently is and put newfound pressure on Republicans to accept some revenue increases in exchange for the entitlement reform. And Boehner and McConnell have at least put people on this committee who presumably will at least give it a hearing.
Well, we will keep an eye on that, and I will be I'll be on Twitter and tweeting from the Red State Gathering. So check me out at Matt K. Lewis this weekend.
And is the gathering going to be streamed in any way?
That's a good question. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
I guess check out redstate.com for any details on that. Maybe there'll be a C-SPAN 3 camera swirling around?
I hope not, because I want the exclusive dollars. So. But maybe so.
Well, I hope you can get some barbecue while you're down there.
Yeah. Although I like the Texas barbecue.
Texas barbecue.
But South Carolina's nice, and Charleston is another beautiful city. So
no sauce with Texas barbecue. Kind of sauce.
I like the Texas barbecue. It's all, you know, different strokes for different folks, right?
Well, at least get some mustard based while you're there. At least, you know, when in Rome, you know, do as the Romans do.
I'm sure I'll have some as well as good seafood, as Charleston oftentimes boasts. Very good seafood.
Well, always good talking to you, Matt.
Good talking to you, Bill.
We'll catch you next week on This Week in Blog.
Out of here.